As I was saying, this would be the least sophisticated mathematically of all of the presentations you have today. I worked for an insurance company for 5 years and then a consulting firm for 25, so that's 30 years of practice. And during those 30 years of practice, my mathematical skills did not become deeper and deeper. I, in fact, lost almost all of them. But it wasn't as painful as I'd imagined, because early on in my career I found it incredibly frustrating to have all these mathematical theories about how people should behave, and then day after day after day be ground down by the reality that nobody thought that way and nobody did those things. The impression you get today if you read the papers in Canada is that we have severe problems in our retirement savings system. Our seniors have about half the income of our working people, so they are presumed to be poor, and the system is presumed to be failing. And our boomers are widely viewed as being spendthrift and narcissistic. They sort of, the view of them is they have no discipline, they don't know how to save, they don't know how to invest, they're stumbling forward blindly without enough money, and they'll never be able to afford to retire. And the problem is none of these theories seem to withstand even the very first test of reasonableness. The very first test to me always was take a look at the retired Canadians and see how they're doing. And it's a test that's seldom applied. And the interesting thing is when you look at retired Canadians, you find that it's true they have half the income of working Canadians, but their standard of living doesn't seem to be any less than the standard of living of working Canadians, because notwithstanding the fact that they have half the income, they are not struggling to pay off their mortgages. Most of them own their homes. Not only do they own their homes are mortgage-free at this point. They're not paying to raise children. And because their incomes are lower in a country with a very progressive income tax system, the tax burden on them is slight, and they don't pay any payroll taxes, and they don't have to save for retirement. So when you actually look at retired Canadians, you find a lot of things that don't fit the model. You find, yes, low income, but no obvious strain in their standard of living. You find that retired Canadians have lower income than working Canadians, but they have the lowest poverty rate of any age group for almost any demographic characteristic, men, women, married, single. The poverty rate among retired Canadians, properly measured, and there are a lot of improper measures, is lower than it is for any other age group. You find, notwithstanding all the talk of annuitizing, retired Canadians, it's very hard to find the ones that will even encroach on capital. They, as a rule, have their money. They view themselves as having sacrificed heroically to accumulate it, and they're not about to spend any of it. They like keeping it. They worry that the government will find a way to trick them out of it. They don't encroach. They save. If you look at 80, 90-year-old wealthy Canadians and say how rapidly are they encroaching on their capital as the end nears, the answer is not at all. In fact, they're earning a bunch of interest. They're unable to even spend the interest they earn. They're saving up money furiously, and nobody's really sure why. Some people say it's because they love their children so much that they want to leave large amounts of money. I don't believe that for a moment. I think that the reason for most of them, if you ask them, is they're worried about what will happen when they get old. And I think the 80-year-olds worry about that, and I think the 90-year-olds worry about that. In fact, I think the operating assumption for most elderly Canadians as far as life expectancy is that they will not die. Now, you know, if you ask them, they know in their heart of hearts, they know they will die. And they even know that their life expectancy is not that far into the future. But they do not behave. They do not behave as if they believe. They are very reluctant to confront that fact. So let me talk then about what I've found as a practitioner in dealing with retirement savings plans, both defined benefit and defined contribution. Now, let me start with the defined contribution plan, or the RSP, the savings plan, because that's the one that I think is most familiar to people. And if you looked at this from the participant's perspective, you'll find that there are many risks that they worry about. Some are obvious, some not so obvious. They worry that the markets will perform poorly, and that happens from time to time. And if you look historically and you model it, what people would like to think is over a working lifetime it always averages out and every generation is equally fortunate, and that's just not the case. There are good times to retire and bad times to retire, and good times to save and bad times to save. And Canada, we had two long 20-year runs. We had a run from about 1960 to 1980 that was just horrible for retirement savers. The stock market did badly, the bond market did badly, cash did badly, inflation was high. You just, no matter where you went, you couldn't hide from it. Then we had 20 years where even the dumbest strategy worked well. From 1980 to 2000, if you told someone, go out and invest badly and earn poor returns, they would have been unable to find a way to do it because all of the asset classes did well. So the bottom line is, it is legitimate for a group of people to worry about whether their times will be good times for the capital markets or not so good times. There's a risk that employees will invest badly, and personally, I can remember when I started consulting, I was told one of the reasons you don't have DC plans is because employees left to their own devices will only buy guaranteed income certificates. They won't buy stocks, they won't buy bonds, they won't buy anything that they don't and can't understand. I heard that theory repeated for the best part of a decade. When people started putting in DC plans, it was largely unwarranted. I heard similar stories. Remember when we had the market decline, the concern was the minute that the boomer investors saw for the first time a bear market, they would all dump all their equities. But they didn't. Now, that's not to say they won't. But I think there is a risk that we don't give people enough credit for sticking to their decisions and making good decisions. There are risks that employees might estimate what they need to save, either because they don't understand what they need in the way of retirement income. The standard financial planning guide in Canada says, you start, before you do all the financial stuff, you start by writing down how much income you need when you retire. There's not one Canadian in 100 can hazard a decent guess about what that is. They eventually all default to 70% or 65 or 80, whatever number they pick as a rule of thumb, because Canadians largely don't know where their money goes, at least not till they retire. There's a risk that they could outlive their savings, but as I said, that to me is more a theoretical risk than a practical one, because in fact, the seniors don't encroach on capital. They don't even buy annuities. They seem to try to live off their investment income and their pensions. Forced early retirement's a big risk. You can do the most elaborate plan in the world about how much you need to save to retire at 65, but if you're pitched out of your job at 58, and if you have a hard time finding another job, the plan is right down the tubes. And anybody who does the modeling knows how you live in retirement is very, very dependent on the age at which you choose to retire. People who want to retire rich at 55 need to save an awful lot more than people who want to retire rich at 65. And lastly, inflation, which was a big issue in the early 80s, and I think it's sort of receding from people's concerns. And and I read a lot that says, 2-3% inflation still over the length of time a retired Canadian lives is a significant amount, and it is. But one of the interesting things, if you study the expenditures of retired Canadians, is if you look at the older retired Canadians, you find that their income is less than younger retired Canadians. So the 85-year-olds have lower income than the 65-year-olds, but they don't save any less. They just spend less. And it's not they spend less because they don't have the money, because they're saving. They spend less just because they choose to spend less. So they're, and I've seen this in my relatives. I strongly suspect that after about the age of 70 or 75, most people will find the amount of money they choose to spend in a year will start to ratchet down, either for health reasons or because they've already done it or for whatever. But that seems to be in the statistics, and it seems to be in the behavior of the people I see. Now, a lot of these risks can be managed, and the other presentations are basically giving us views about how to manage the risks. and you get things like age-related asset mixes, and everybody knows you diversify. Some of the risks, they're just the risk that people will do stupid thing, you can address either with education or advice. You can try to persuade seniors to annuitize so they don't outlive their money. But the bottom line is, at least my conclusion, you can do all of these things. There still aren't any guarantees. You know, there is the possibility that sound strategies may not produce happy outcomes. And for some generations, I think that's going to be the case. And there's also the possibility that safe strategies will require significant sacrifice. So there's no panacea here from the perspective of the retirement saver. They can learn about these things, they can follow these strategies, they can hope for the best, but in the final analysis, there's no guarantee that things work, and they have to be prepared to deal with disappointment. The risks that they can't avoid or eliminate at an acceptable price must ultimately be borne. And if you had a retirement savings plan, and around 2000 you had a path of how it was going to work out, and then you revisit it 4 years later after the market debacle, a lot of Canadians find that whatever the plan was, they're now off the path. And the question is, how are they supposed to deal with it? And there are a bunch of things they can do. They can save more. They could choose more aggressive investments. I've got qualms about that, but it does, in some sense, it's tempting. They could retire later, or they can learn to get by on less once they do retire. Now, I guess what I see most of the papers on is the first two, really about the first one. I mean, you can save more, but how much more, and how do you invest it? And what I see people doing are mostly the last two, very few of them, I think, will take the approach, I've been burned in the stock market, I now need to earn greater returns, this is the time to double up, let's go for it. The mathematics on that may work out, but the psychology, in my experience, doesn't. You know, if they burned once, they're not going to get burned twice. So it seems that the human part of the decision pushes them in the opposite direction. Saving more is painful. You know, there aren't many who, when told that now they can save 30% of their income as they make that last five-year spurt to retirement age, are actually going to decide to do that. You know, they'll quickly find, you know, when they say, well, how many extra years do I have to work so I can keep saving 15 or 20%, when they're told 1 year, they'll say, well, that seems like a lot more viable approach. I'll just work a year longer and get back on my plan that way. Getting by on less is always the default position. You know, that when you sort of can't work any longer because you lose your job or because you hate your job, and all the financial strategies have still produced an amount that in your view is too little, then you do what may be the most Canadian of things, you learn to get by on less. And I can just tell you from looking at the seniors, they seem pretty comfortable with this 50% of the income of working people. Like when you survey them and say, you know, how's your life going? Are you happy? Are you not? Da, 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 da. And you find that notwithstanding their income, you know, they think they're living as well now as they used to live. They think their life's pretty good. You know, when they're asked what are they unhappy about, it's almost always health and relationships. It's almost never money. And there's a lesson in that I think probably people who aren't seniors have not yet learned, that they just seem to muddle along and live quite comfortably without having huge amounts of money. Now, if you look at an employee aging, and this will be obvious to everybody in the room, your retirement savings situation changes dramatically as you age, and this was, illustrated very effectively in Roger's graphs, where you have the human capital going down, the financial capital going up, and the financial capital tailing late in life. So as people age, as they move farther into their retirement plan, the risk exposure goes up and their ability and inclination to bear risk diminishes. Now, this I'm different than many of the other speakers because they would offer proof of their assertions, and I will just assert them. And that's one of the differences between a practitioner and an academic. My audience quickly falls asleep if proof is offered for any assertion, and so we just we just have to keep throwing out the assertions to try to keep them awake. Now, this ability and inclination to bear risk, I've reached this conclusion from a very small sample of relatives and in-laws. What it really came down to is they will not admit to this. If I talked to my mother or my mother-in-law when she was living about sort of how she felt about taking risk, she felt very able to take risk and was quite prepared to take risk. But then you just had to listen long enough, because eventually, before she got to the end of her description of her her willingness to take risks, there was, as long as I don't lose money. And there is the rub, and I see it now in pension committees. There were a lot of pension committees in the late 90s thought they had an almost, they were completely unconcerned about risk. You do the model and you'd say, well, there could be a precipitous decline here, and you'd feel very badly about that. But all the whole experience had been, surplus and good times. And they imagined in a very academic sense that if they lost money, they would assemble, meet as a group, and say, we knew this could happen. We're not rattled by this. Let's soldier on. And what they found out when the markets did go down and they met as a group is their whole worldview had changed. Imagining you lose money and losing money are two different things. When you really lose money, you really feel bad. And when you've got bad news for the CFO and bad news for the CEO and bad news for the shareholders, it's much more painful than many of them imagined. So what we see, at least what I'm seeing, is a lot of pension funds are rethinking just how comfortable they are with bearing risk. And that's a sort of a tragic thing when you look at it, because when I came into the business, the worst mistake people made is when they lost money, they bail from the stocks. That was like sort of beginner's mistake number one. And when I came in, it was at the end of a fairly bad market for stocks in the 70s, and everybody was doing that. And the consultants said, that's not the right reason to dump your stocks. That's a well-known unsuccessful strategy. You don't dump things just because they've gone down. You don't buy them just because they've gone up. And we made our clients more sophisticated. So now we start running models. And the model says, how risk-averse are you? And when the stocks run up, they say, we're very risk-tolerant. And the model says, oh, you can hold a lot of equities. And then when the market goes down, we take the model and run it again in light of their new circumstances. And we say, now, how able are you to bear risk? And I say, we hate risk. There's nothing we hate more than risk. And the model spits back, you better dump those stocks. And so that's why when I started in this, I said it's going to take a generation, for the insights of financial economists to penetrate the boardroom. And now I've gone a generation and it's not happening. And I'm beginning to get pessimistic it ever will happen, because it's, in the final analysis, these are people, and they're very human. And the human thing to do is sometimes not the right thing to do. Okay. Now, I want to look at this from the employer's perspective, because one of the things that I think employers need to be careful of is there's a view that if they don't like the risk of defined benefit plans, if employers get into a defined contribution plan, they put the risk on the employees, and that there is very little risk for the employer. And while we haven't been at this very long, we strongly suspect that at the end of the day, if you have a DC plan for your employees and the DC plan does badly for your employees generationally, that you are exposed. And you are exposed to the following things. First, there is a concern that if your relative returns are poor, that you might be successfully sued. In Canada, we don't have the kind of safe havens you have under ERISA in the States. And anybody can march off into court and say that the employer was irresponsible in choosing the wrong fund providers and claim that they've been hurt as a consequence and should be compensated. Now, we haven't had the suit, and there are a lot of lawyers optimistic they'll win the suit. And there are, and that's sadly on both sides of the table. There are a lot of lawyers optimistic that they'll win the suit. So it remains to be seen. There are also concerns if the employees contribute too little or invest poorly, that they'll be able to claim at the end of the day that they were given the expectation that participating in this plan would take care of their retirement needs, and if it doesn't, they will sue. You know, I'd like to think that that won't be a successful suit, but everybody in the pension business who has seen the courts in action has no confidence that almost any claim, no matter how ridiculous, if it's addressed by an older person against a company, can do other than succeed, because that's the one thing we see in most of the decisions, is the court will do very strange things to conclude that companies should pay members. The last and the more serious risks are if your employees can't afford to retire and you're a company, you've got to think through what that means. You know, what you know, it's been a long time since in Canada, in fact we've probably never seen a large contingent of angry older workers, all of whom don't want to work, but all of whom feel let down by the company pension plan, which hasn't allowed them to accumulate enough money to retire. I think it'll be quite an ugly spectacle when we're confronted with it. I don't buy all of this stuff that employers want the boomers to work forever and the boomers want to work forever and they're uniquely talented and that they're not growing old like their parents. I just see too little evidence of it in my life. So I think there's a large risk that if your DC plan doesn't work out at the end of the day, you've got a workforce that's unhappy, will probably become unproductive, and you'll end up having to sever them, and severance is very expensive for long service older people. The court assumes properly they'll never get another job, that they've been with you for a long time, and the awards are pretty high. Okay, let me move to the defined benefit plan and try to go through this very quickly. DB plans create, change, eliminate, and shift risk. They create some risk, they eliminate others. From an employee's perspective, in theory, if you're in the DB plan, you don't need to worry about performance of capital markets, adequacy of savings rates, investment decisions, or outliving your savings. Those things, if it's a good DB plan, are probably all taken care of for you. However, for every risk they eliminate, they create a different risk. You now have a possibility of forfeitures on termination of employment, and sometimes on early retirement. You can forego benefits if you don't retire early, because a lot of these plans have large incentives to retire early. If you don't retire early, you give up that incentive. They can, and most of them do, expose you to inflation, sometimes during your working lifetime, more often thereafter. You run the risk that you'll lose benefits if the plans wind up while they're poorly funded, and that's a risk very evident in the papers today. And you end up indirectly exposed to poor market performance, because what does happen in a way that nobody really fully understands is if the markets perform poorly, the plan becomes very expensive for the employer. The employer then finds their employment costs are going up faster than their productivity, and they look to do things to deal with that. And that can be anything from laying people off to not giving the raises they otherwise would have given, to looking for ways to cut back pension and benefits plans. So you have an indirect exposure as an employee, even in a DB plan. For employers, the risks they create are pretty obvious. You're exposed to poor stock markets, declining interest rates, and low inflation. Low inflation only to the extent that that gets into interest rates and stock market returns. A growing risk in Canada is legal risk. And I won't go into all of the sad stories, but if you look, it's very interesting. If 5 years ago in Canada, most plans had surpluses, and the stories in the newspaper and the lawsuits were about the fact that we had these large surpluses created by deserving employees, and instead of spending the money on better benefits, the employers were taking contribution holidays, and the injustice of that. We've seen a whole string of suits. There's one in the paper today where a company is being sued by retired employees because they took a surplus and gave a contribution holiday to the employer and to active employees. and the retired employees are claiming that was completely unjust. It was their surplus and it had to be used for them. And you know, we'll see what happens with it. Then the disturbing thing is you get into the market decline, where now all the stories change. Now instead of the story of the huge pot of surplus and who's going to get it, there's this massive yawning deficiency. I'm waiting for the very first story, and I hope Jim Doss, sitting right there in the second row, is going to write it, that asks the question that would be the natural question, because the question we used to get is, why shouldn't the retirees share in the surplus that they helped to create? I'm waiting for the first story on why aren't retirees sharing in the deficit they helped to create. But no one's writing that story. All people are writing is, isn't it disgraceful that the employers aren't eliminating this deficit by making large contributions at the fastest possible pace? Now, if I, as a shareholder, have been being told that my organization had entered into an arrangement where they guarantee people a pot of money, stick the money in the stock market. If it goes up, everybody fights about the surplus. And if it goes down, you make up the shortfall. That doesn't look like a good plan to me. And yet, more and more, as these court decisions come in and as these class action suits are filed, that's looking like the reality for the sponsor of the defined benefit plan in Canada. Collective bargaining risks. You know, you run a surplus in a defined benefit plan, it won't be long before the union notices it and takes the view that retirees take, that that's their money, and that the proper way to use the money is to improve the benefit. So the surplus is exposed to that. The plans are exposed to changing standards, both actuarial and accounting. You know, we've seen both recently, and we'll see more, you know, where you think you understand the rules, but the accountants decide that those aren't the rules, the rules will be different, and risks that you thought you didn't have now become significant risks. And basically, I'm a big supporter of moving to mark-to-market. I think that's the right answer. I think it sends a disturbing message to sponsors of DB plans, but it's a message that they really need to pay some attention to. But the fact is, that's a huge change if you're not used to it. A huge change for the reader of the financial statement, and a huge change for the organization who's sponsoring the plan. Faulty design is another risk. You don't read about this much, but give the obvious example. A lot of defined benefit plans build in handcuffs. So the benefit is designed so the individual who leaves before retirement age takes a large financial loss. Now, this was done deliberately to make sure that those productive, valuable, long service employees are wedded permanently to the organization once they get into their late 40s. Now, those of you who remember the early 90s, remember we entered into an environment where all of a sudden companies decided that they didn't want those valuable, long-service, experienced employees to stay with the organization. They had, in fact, become overpaid employees. And the question was, how do you get them to leave? And the answer is you got to first take the handcuffs off, because none of them would be silly enough to leave, you know, if a pension plan says you're walking away from half your pension, which is what a lot of the provisions, in essence, did. Early retirement incentives may be the second coming of this. There's now, increasingly people are of the view, I'm not sure it's a correct view, but increasingly they are of the view that as the boomers leave the workforce, organizations will want to retain older workers. Again, I don't see any evidence of it yet, but if you do accept that premise, many of these same organizations have pension plans that are very expensive precisely to encourage those older workers to leave in their late 50s or early 60s. So, you know, some of these designs that look very clever in bringing out and rewarding certain behaviors become very dangerous if you keep changing your mind about the behavior you want to reward. Because you can't change these things. You know, once you tell someone you're going to be able to retire at 60 with an unreduced pension, you know, you try going to them when they're 50 or 48 and telling them you've had a change of plan. You know, it's these things, once you set them, are very hard to change. The DB plan, as they mature, begins looking very different. You know, many of the graphs you see today are about how things change as people age. It's always surprised me how similar a defined benefit pension plan in its life cycle is to an individual. I mean, you'd think it shouldn't be so, but the fact is they start as small entities with small asset bases and huge ability to bear risk. and you roll them out 50 years later and you find a whole bunch of things. One, the pool of assets has grown much faster than the organization. Secondly, you know, the employee population has grown much older being two things. One, you now have a mature group of retired people, probably half your money for, in the pension fund is for people who don't work for you anymore, and the other group has grown older. Next thing you find is your business has matured, which means you don't have a rapidly growing workforce anymore, you've got a shrinking workforce, as you have to be more and more productive in sort of a sunset industry to compete with offshore suppliers. So when you put all of these things together, you know, a mature workforce, a mature business, and the last one you have to contend with is the plan itself tends to mature. They tend to get more and more generous as time goes by. Put that all together, all of a sudden you end up with a risk that you thought was going to be inconsequential if you were a patient long-term investor. Turns out to be absolutely huge. I mean, I've got a number of very large pension plans where the pension assets are approaching 10 times payroll. And so you do the arithmetic. You're 50-50 stocks and bonds. The standard deviation of the return, your annual portfolio returns 8%, let's say. Your asset base is 10 times payroll. So you take 8%, 10 times payroll. That's every year your gain and loss in the pension fund, mark to market, 80% of payroll. No, this is a mammoth risk. Now, these are organizations that are trying to figure out how to pair percentages off payroll. You know, if they get three bad years in the stock market, they're toast. You know, and not, that wasn't, I think, properly appreciated when the plans were young. There was a presumption that if you could deal with the risk then, you could deal with the risk later. But when the business changes and the plan changes and the workforce changes, everything changes, that wasn't the best of assumptions. So, bottom line is, today we've got some pension plans in Canada and in the UK and in the US that have got some very tough decisions to make. The bottom line is the whole premise underlying the plan. When the organization concluded the plan was affordable, it did not conclude that on the basis of a riskless interest rate. It concluded that on the basis that if they were long-term investors, they could safely rely on earning a significant equity premium that would make their pension plan affordable. When they look at it today and they say, what can we do? They find literally they're between a rock and a hard place. Option one, keep taking the risk. You know, you might be able to afford the plan, but you won't be able to afford the fluctuations. Option two, get rid of the risk, at which point they turn around and say, how much does that cost? And what you find is you can get rid of the risk, but then you can't afford the plan. And that doesn't leave them anything that they're comfortable with. It's not the plan they thought they bought. It's not the situation they thought they'd be in. They want the equity premium without the equity risk. They were told if they were patient long-term investors, they could have that. The market lately hasn't been delivering it, and that's causing a lot of concern in the pension business.